Kane drew deeply on the cigar, then blew it out. The taste of the cigar eradicated some of the stink of the sea. The canvas sails popped and cracked overhead as the ship's crew brought them all in line with the wind. They tacked farther west, going with the strength of the wind rather than trying to skirt around it. The sun had settled lower in the western sky, and reflections danced on the ocean's surface. The ship's crew had tied up the powerboat to a stern cleat and given it plenty of length to stay clear of the ship. As Kane stared out over the water, it seemed as though he could hear Balam calling his name. His chest still ached from the heavy bruising, but it was already starting to feel a little better. Lethargy filled him, making his limbs feel like lead.
Kane.
Turning, Kane faced Brigid. He still seemed to hear Balam's voice on the wind.
What is it, Baptiste?
Do you think Campecheville is the best place to head?
Why not?
Because if Baron Samarium has decided to wage war against the escaping slaves and the people who are helping them get away, he might have sea-based teams along the way to Campecheville. We could get intercepted.
Kane shook his head and immediately felt dizzy. He took a small stumbling step that most people would never have noticed or would have attributed to the rolling carriage of the ship sailing the sea. Brigid grabbed his arm, ready to help steady him if he needed it.
Are you all right?
Kane drew his arm back from her, removing her hand gently.
I'm fine, Baptiste. I'm just tired.
Brigid looked into his eyes, then put a hand against his forehead.
You're burning up, Kane. The fever has come back.
I'll be fine. Probably whatever bug it is hasn't worked its way completely through my system yet. I'll get some more fluids and some rest. It'll pass.
Unless it's something serious.
It'll pass.
Brigid looked at him doubtfully.
Maybe not, if Balam is involved.
That was just a dream.
Maybe it wasn't.
You're worrying too much, Baptiste.
And I think you're not worrying enough.
Kane looked out at the rolling sea, feeling the deck shifting constantly underfoot, listening to the creak of the rigging and the snap of the canvas overhead, and wished he felt better. It was one thing to be facing all the problems before them while he was well, but being sick was draining.
I'm worried, Baptiste. But mostly, I'm worried about these people.
He glanced at the ship's passengers, noticing that Angel and Cherub had made it safely.
And I'm concerned about that Mattrans unit that suddenly went online down there.
Brigid stood at his side quietly.
I still think it would be in your best interests to return to the Cerberus Redoubt.
When we get to Campecheville, we can use the Mattrans unit if there's an emergency. At this point, Campecheville is probably closer and more safely reached than any other place we could jump from.
He glanced at the stern. Grant was leaning down into the fat captain's face while Domi looked on with a stone-cold expression. Fiddler watched for a moment, but her attention remained riveted on the burning fill along the shoreline. Sometimes Jeweled Lady dove so deeply down into the next trough that the land disappeared completely. Kane remembered the room full of clowns that had been in the Gaudy. Maybe Fiddler hadn't made the villa a true home, but she'd invested in it. He doubted that she'd get any of those things back, even if they hadn't been destroyed in the explosions. He turned back to Brigid.
And you don't have to be concerned about Baron Samarium posting naval vessels out here. First, doing something like that would strain his manpower and hardware resources. Then, any ships he put at sea would be fair game for pirates. Besides, it takes a crew to man a ship. Magistrates aren't going to do the grunt work aboard one of these things.
You're probably right.
I am.
Kane peered out at the ocean to the south. The wind whistled past him, and he thought he heard Balam's voice in it again.
Kane, I'll be waiting.
Wait then, dammit, Kane thought, and he hoped he hadn't spoken out loud, because he was suddenly very unsure. He walked to the railing and leaned on it to steady himself, hating the weakness that seemed to gnaw at him a little more with each passing second.
Kane.
Lakesh?
Blinking tiredly, Lakesh looked up from the comp screen he'd been studying. Charts and maps of Campeche, Quintana Roo, and the Yucatan Peninsula occupied different monitors around him. He glanced at the Mercator map and saw the yellow blips that identified the Cerberus group's locations. They were well away from the Texas shoreline now. The wind had been favorable.
What is it, friend Bri?
Lakesh pushed up from his chair and crossed the room to the little man's workstation. Bry stared at one of the comp screens in front of him.
It's Kane.
He still has the fever.
Bry consulted one of the digital tables in front of him.
Yes, 5 minutes ago he just jumped 2.6 degrees.
That puts him at 103.3.
Bry nodded.
He must be delusional.
He's also hitting his REM cycle now.
Luckish consulted the stats and figures on the screen. The REM cycle of a person's sleep indicated a heavy dreaming sequence. Normal REM took up only 20% of an adult's sleep cycle, but Kane had nearly stayed in REM all the previous night before they'd reached the Texas coastline. During charted sleep cycles at Cerberus Redoubt, while injured or otherwise convalescing, Kane had never shown a disruption of that pattern. Lakesh knew something was affecting Kane's sleep, but he had no clue what. However, the fever had to be most certainly part of it, because Kane's fever always jumped up a couple of degrees every time he entered the deep REM. Lakesh folded his arms over his skinny chest. He hated mysteries. He especially hated mysteries that all seemed tied in together somehow, but yet weren't quite within his grasp.
What are you dreaming about with such obvious interest, friend Kane?
Of course, there was no answer. Kane opened his eyes and knew he was dreaming when he found himself walking down a narrow hallway that he recognized as being a pyramid corridor. He carried a reed torch in one hand and walked quietly. Another man's voice echoed softly from the shadows.
Do you know how it is that the pharaohs make sure they have plenty to eat for themselves, as well as the slaves?
No.
Kane responded before he knew he was even going to speak. He was still acclimating, still trying to get used to the idea of where he was.
It's because of the machine Set gave to the pharaohs all those years ago. It makes the food for them out of thin air when the crops fail.
Kane had no idea what the man at his side was talking about. He glanced at the man, finding him vaguely familiar. The man was roughly the same height as Kane himself.
No machine can make food out of thin air.
This one can. I've seen it in operation. I wouldn't bring you here now and risk both our lives if it wasn't important.
I'm a fool for following you here. Maybe a dead fool by morning.
The other man grinned, and Kane almost recognized that grin. There was something so familiar about the man. Then he remembered how he'd seen the man before in the tunnels beneath Djoser's pyramid. Kane held his reed torch high and examined the hieroglyphs on the wall. They were different from the ones that had been put into place in Djoser's temple, and the walls here were covered with them. The work that had gone into carving hieroglyphs into the stone walls would have taken years.
This isn't Djoser's pyramid, is it?
The other man turned suddenly, his hand flashing to the knife at his waist. He held his torch before him to better light the passageway area around Kane and to use as a weapon.
Kane, is it you?
Kane stopped moving, falling automatically into a ready position. He touched the knife belted at his waist as well. In this dream, he was dressed as an overseer, wearing cotton shirt and pants and sandals, like the man before him. Was he someone else then? He wasn't sure. His thinking seemed clouded and fuzzy. Part of him knew that he was still aboard Jeweled Lady, sailing for Campecheville, but another part of him seemed anchored to this time and place.
Who are you?
Are you toying with me again, Kane? Is this the you from now, or are you here from another time and place?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Kane's words were automatic, coming from the person whose mind he partially occupied. The man moved warily. The light from both torches caressed the gleaming edge of the upturned knife held tightly in his hand. The man was young, surely no more than his early 20s.
Are you here to stop me or to help me this time, Kane?
Stop all this crazy talk. You took me away from a fine warm bed and a woman I've not yet had on the pretext of showing me something important. I've got half a mind to turn around and go back to those things.
The young man seemed more nervous than ever. Anxiety tightened his face and fear danced in his eyes with the reflected torchlight.
Whose pyramid is this?
Kane hesitated for a moment, not knowing how to answer, but his voice answered anyway.
Don't be foolish, Harkuf. This is the great temple of Ramses II.
Harkuf's eyes narrowed.
If you knew this place belonged to Ramses II, then why did you ask if it was Djoser's?
If I did, it was only because you woke me from a sound sleep after a jug of wine.
I thought you were with a woman.
I was, but she was patient, a quality that I find lacking in you.
Kane watched the other man relax somewhat.
Now either show me this God's gift you brought me here for, or let me return to my home. Your wretched curiosity will be the death of you. Day. I promise you that.
Somewhere in the real world aboard Jeweled Lady, Kane stirred and felt the pain of his bruised chest. For a moment, he lost contact with the dream, fading out to black. Balaam's voice whispered in his ear.
No, Kane. There is much yet you have to see in order that you might understand. The task that is laid upon you is important.
Balaam? Are you here? Or are you part of this damn fever?
Light flooded into Kane's eyes and he blinked. When he blinked again, he was once more in the pyramid. This time, however, he stood with Harkuf in a large room filled with shelves laden with papyrus scrolls, wax-sealed jars, and a collection of furniture.
Ramses keeps the machine Set gave Djoser in here. But the Israelites have learned of the machine as well. Their leader, Moses, has sent spies throughout Ramses II's courts, searching for this machine.
But you have found it?
I have.
Harkuf walked to the center of the room, where there was an ornate hieroglyph showing Ramses II's efforts to lead the nation to greater glories. There were pictographs of the pharaoh in his war chariot, standing among conquered peoples, among the pyramids, and along the Nile River. Kane watched, feeling the other man's hesitation and fear in his own mind. Although the dreams again reminded him of the few instances he'd glimpsed into other lives that he still wasn't certain he'd actually lived, he was certain this was different. He was aware of the other man and the skull that they shared, but he felt certain the other man didn't know of him. Harkuf stopped in the center of the mosaic. He drew his knife, then knelt and wrapped the hilt against five different tiles. He tapped some of the tiles more than once, and there was a cadence, a blending of sounds that created something more than the individual tones. When Harkuf finished, a section of the floor slid open, and a dais moved smoothly up into place. The alien machine sat on it. The torchlight glittered along the twisted glass tubing and the curved metal surfaces of the three bowls.
What is this?
Kane had seen it before. The words that were being spoken still weren't his own. He tried to move and stretch inside the body, but he had no command over it again. The fleeting control made him feel claustrophobic and trapped.
You haven't seen this before?
No.
But you have to have seen it before. I've shown it to you.
I've never seen this thing before.
Harkuf stepped away from the dais and held his torch high. He shook his head sadly.
Kane, are you in there? Can you hear me?
The only things I hear are the words of a drunken fool.
I'm not drunk, and I'm no fool.
Absently, his hand touched the hilt of the dagger sheathed at his side.
I'm showing you power. The power that the god Set gave the pharaohs. Don't you see it?
I see a contrivance that I don't understand.
Harkuf pointed at the glittering machine.
That is power. The power to be a pharaoh, or even more. If you can feed people, you can lead people. That is what the pharaohs have learned. Haven't you learned that famine is the thing the people of this land fear most?
The gods willing, there will never be famine in these lands again.
Not the gods. This machine. That's why Set gave it to the pharaohs. And that's why the Israelite leader, Moses, is so interested in it. He has learned of the machine from his position within the pharaoh's court. Ramses II has been unwise in some respects. Secrets are best kept by one alone.
Yet you share yours with me now.
Harkuf shook his head.
I thought I saw Kane in your eyes.
You talk madness. I know no one named Kane, nor do I know that name. It sounds like an outlander name.
Harkuf grinned.
An outlander name? You speak prophecy, and you don't even know it. In times to come, Kane will be an outlander. But the world then will be very different than what you see now.
Are you a prophet then, Harkuf? To speak of times to come? Like one of the enslaved Israelite tribes that build our pyramids?
No, I'm only a traveler, seeking to understand what my place in the skein of this thing is.
He glanced back at the machine.
I was given an understanding of this machine a long time ago.
You are too young to be speaking this way.
I'm young this time. When I get insight through my dreams, I'm not always young. Sometimes I'm a very old man.
You speak in riddles. I'm going back to my bed and that jug of wine. And maybe, if she hasn't gotten totally pissed about me leaving, I'll find the woman there, too.
Kane found himself turning to go.
I can't let you do that.
Kane turned, instantly wary.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that I'm sorry. I'd hoped seeing the machine might awaken Cain inside you, and we might do this thing together.
What thing?
I'm going to take the machine.
That belongs to the Pharaoh.
Not anymore.
Harkuf drew his knife from his waist and lunged forward. Cain felt a change within the body, like the tension going out of a spring, and found he was no longer trapped in the flesh and blood prison. He shifted his weight instinctively, bringing up his left arm to block the knife attack. He slapped against the inside of Harkuf's wrist, stopping the knife's descent immediately. Harkuf's eyes widened.
Cain, is it you?
I don't know you.
You know me, but you forgot me, just as I forgot. But I'm remembering now, Cain. More and more of what I'd forgotten is coming back. Isn't it coming back for you?
No.
The man searched Cain's eyes.
Where are you, Cain? Where do you think you are?
I don't know what you're talking about.
The man smiled.
You think you're dreaming, don't you?
Cain didn't say anything. Their torches lay on the floor, and their shadows, long and gaunt, twisted on the walls as they stepped back from each other.
I used to think I was dreaming. I thought I was going insane. But I was only remembering, Cain.
Cain circled the other man warily.
Who are you?
I've had many names, Cain, just as you have. And I've died many deaths. It no longer scares me.
He kept the knife low and inside, his elbows tucked in close to his sides, making him less vulnerable to attack. His feet moved in small steps, gliding across the floor. Silently, Cain mirrored the other man's moves, adjusting his defense every time his opponent shifted in a major way.
And you're always around the machine, Cain. Why is that?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I've had dreams like this all my life. Have you?
No.
I think you're lying.
Cain didn't respond. One of the torches guttered and went out, leaving only the remaining torch to light the room. Darkness crept in around them.
Every time I meet you, though, I never know if you're there to help me or to stop me. You do both, you know.
Cain thought back to his earlier dreams of Egypt.
I've met you only once before.
When?
It was under Djoser's pyramid.
Bright excitement burned through Harkuf's eyes.
Yes, you do remember.
Only for a moment. You were an overseer then.
Harkuf grinned.
And now I am not. That's how the wheel turns, Cain. But this is only the price I have to pay to one day be a king. You know about Enlil, don't you? And the baronies? How the barons are all hybrids, a mix of alien and human races, and the way they destroyed the world?
Who are you?
Harkuf grinned as if he was telling a favorite joke.
Now or then, Cain? You know how maddening these dreaming memories are. I believed I was going insane until I found the first piece of the machine Enlil gave the pharaohs.
Cain's mind spun, and he knew some of it had to do with the fever that racked his body in the real world. At least, he thought of his existence aboard Jeweled Lady as being in the real world.
And then I found the second piece, right where the dreams showed me it would be.
What is this machine?
Although Harkuf appeared relaxed, he continued moving, circling steadily to Cain's left.
It makes the nectar of the gods, Cain. That machine can make food from the very air itself, and it can feed armies of people. And if you can feed a people...
You can lead a people.
Harkuf smiled.
Yes. So why are you here this time?
I don't know.
Without warning, Harkuf stopped circling.
I'm going to take the machine now, Cain. Are you going to let me?
No. He can't be allowed to take the machine.
What is it? What do you hear?
Noticing that the torch's flame had frozen and time had stopped again, leaving only himself and Harkuf free to move, Cain turned, gazing into the shadows around him. Balaam stood nearly 10 feet away, clothed in shadows and his robes. His skin was pinkish-gray from the weak light of the torch. When he spoke, his voice resonated within the room, not Cain's mind.
You must stop him.
Who the hell is this?
Cain looked at the two individuals before him, trying to make sense of everything that was going on.
I am Balaam.
Harkuf stepped closer, but kept a safe distance.
You're one of the aliens, like Enlil.
Not like Enlil.
What's going on?
The stakes are high in this endeavor, Cain. This man can't be allowed to possess the machine Enlil gave to the pharaohs. It belongs to someone else, at least for a time.
Who? The Israelites?
Things must be as they're supposed to be.
Balaam looked only at Cain.
Is this the past, or am I only dreaming?
This is the past, Kane. But this is a very fragile past that now reaches into the present and can alter the future.
What are you talking about?
Kane shifted again and felt the pain of his bruised chest.
This man has been tied to the machine that Enlil gave the Pharaohs. That connection has allowed him to find two of the three pieces of the machine in the time-space you now occupy. Given time, he will find the third piece.
Was it on the German warship in World War II? I've recently dreamed about that.
Balam ignored him.
Why should I stop him?
Because you're the only one who can end the threat of Enlil's machine. You made a promise to the lady. Only by fulfilling that can you end the menace that Enlil's machine posits.
What lady?
Balam didn't have time to answer because Harkuf launched himself across the distance, the knife gleaming in the torchlight. Kane reacted immediately, feeling himself slip into the magistrate hand-to-hand combat mode. He slapped Harkuf's knife attack away, then delivered a short roundhouse punch to his opponent's face. However, Harkuf managed to slip most of the punch's power and spin, sweeping a leg up toward the side of Kane's head. Unable to avoid the kick completely, Kane rolled with it. Spots swam before his eyes with kaleidoscopic intensity. He moved again at once, sidestepping another kick and rolling into a spinning back fist that hammered Harkuf across the face and knocked him to the ground. Blood gushed from Harkuf's broken nose, looking black in the dimly lit shadows. Still, he was up almost immediately, ending Kane's chances of putting a quick finish to the fight. Questions spun in Kane's brain, even as he struggled to keep his senses focused. If this was real and not some fever-induced dream, what was Balam doing there? And what was the machine? Harkuf came at him again with the knife, cutting the air on both sides of Kane's head as he gave ground. Kane focused on his opponent, measuring Harkuf's reach and stride, getting a feel for how aggressive the man would be if he let him keep coming. Without warning, the torch on the floor started flickering again. Kane watched as the warm orange glow cascaded across Harkuf's face. Then, just as suddenly, he realized that more lights had entered the pyramid's room. Stepping back from Harkuf, who had frozen in place, Kane swept the newcomers with a glance. They were all hard men, wasted by forced labor, long days, and harsh weather. They held sharpened pieces of metal and a few weapons. Their leader was young, his beard fierce and dark, his black hair in disarray.
There! There is the machine I was given knowledge of through my visions. Come on, my brothers. We have only to take it, and unholy wrath will descend upon the lands of our captors, and we shall be set free.
40 men poured into the small room with quiet, desperate haste. Kane tried to defend himself and resisted several opportunities to kill the men who fought him. Still, there was no escape, and when they saw that he couldn't harm them, there were mutterings that they were protected by Moses' divinity. They closed more quickly, drowning Kane in their sheer numbers.
Balam!
For some inexplicable reason, the men entering the room hadn't attacked Balam at all.
Rest easy, Kane. You will wake soon. This is something that happened a long time ago.
If this already happened, then why did I have to be here?
Are you here, Kane? Or do you only dream this?
Tell me!
In time, Kane. Only in time. You have farther to go. For now, in this time, you've seen enough and done enough.
What did I do?
Kane felt a knife pierce his chest.
You have prevented Enlil's machine from being taken at the wrong time. That's all that needed to be done here. Enlil didn't see the true danger of the machine he brought to this place for centuries. Then he entrusted the delivery of the world from the machine to a king. Sleep. We will talk again when the time is right.
Blackness filled Kane's vision. Balam's voice and Harkuf's yells grew dim and finally faded, leaving only white noise humming in his ears.
Kane. Kane, wake up.
Drenched in fevered sweat, the stink of brine filling his nostrils, Kane woke on the pitching deck of Jeweled Lady with Bridget at his side.
I'm all right.
He shook off her hand irritably. He was aware that other passengers were awake and watching him. Some of the men watched him with hot, hungry eyes.
I'm just trying to help.
Bridget coldly drew away to put her back up against the ship's railing. Kane's head felt as if it weighed 1,000 pounds. He breathed out gently, feeling the ache in his bruised chest.
It's not you, Baptiste. It's the people around us. If they see weakness in Fiddler or any of us, they're going to be scared and uncertain. Like it or not, we're leading this escape attempt, and those people are going to be expecting us to be leaders. Especially in light of the way we left Fiddlerville, one step ahead of the magistrates.
Bridget remained quiet. Kane let the silence draw out for a time, listening to the smack of the waves against the boat's hull and feeling the cool night air wash over him. Before he knew it, the heat of the fever drained away and left only freezing temperatures in its place. When he spoke, it was hard to keep his teeth from chattering.
Returning to Cerberus Redoubt wasn't the answer, Baptiste.
You're sick. The last place you need to be is out here.
Kane had difficulty swallowing because his throat was so dry.
I don't think so. We're supposed to be here.
A curious look flirted with Bridget's beautiful face.
Is that the fever talking?
No.
You had another dream.
Kane hesitated only a moment, knowing he couldn't lie to Bridget.
Yes.
Of Egypt?
Yes. But the time period was different. Ramses II was pharaoh. He was the leader of Egypt when the Israelites were there.
The story of Exodus from the Christian Old Testament begins there.
Kane struggled to remember what he knew of the religion. It hadn't been something he'd been terribly interested in while he'd been at Cobaltville, and the fever and pain in his head made it hard to remember things he might have otherwise remembered with no trouble at all.
There was a man named Moses.
He led the 12 tribes of Israel from the lands of the pyramid builders.
I don't know about that, Baptiste. But he was there in my dream.
Moses?
The idea seemed to interest Bridget and trouble her all at the same time.
Yeah. He came after the machine that Enlil gave Djoser.
Kane told her about the dream, having an easy time reconstructing it because it was so fresh in his mind.
The mana machine.
Kane shook his head and regretted it when the pain reached a flashing crescendo that made his vision spot and his stomach roll threateningly.
I haven't heard about that.
Bridget's brows furrowed as she searched her photographic memory.
I have. I read about it in the Cobaltville archives. How much do you know about the Christian Bible?
Not much, Baptiste. I've never read it, but I've heard passages of it in the outlands in different places. Prayers for funerals and marriages and births still exist in different forms throughout most places. But then so do all kinds of other religions. Some of them probably weren't even around before the new cost.
There's a story in the Old Testament about Moses and the way he led the Israelites from the Pharaoh. Many biblical scholars believe that the Pharaoh the Israelites were escaping was Ramses II, although you can find other documentation that the Pharaoh was someone else.
The story, Baptiste.
Cain wrapped his arms around himself in an effort to keep warm.
You're cold?
Yes. It's the fever. It'll pass.
Bridget frowned.
If the fever passes...
It'll pass, damn it. Get on with the story.
Anything Kane thought to help him forget about the pain filling his head. Bridget pushed herself up.
I'll be right back.
Irritated, thinking it would serve Bridget right if he was asleep by the time she got back, Kane leaned back against the railing and tried to relax. He and Grant had talked earlier and divided up the watch, neither of them willing to trust the captain and crew, or Fiddler for that matter. Since leaving the Ville and being trapped aboard Jeweled Lady, Fiddler hadn't exactly been a social butterfly. As it turned out, she'd lost two members of her crew in the firefight, despite her best attempts to keep the upper hand during the confrontation. She hadn't blamed Kane, but she obviously hadn't felt like seeking out his company either. Kane didn't fault her, and he had his own concerns, especially when the fever returned with a vengeance. He'd also noticed that she'd set up her own watch, even though the crew of Jeweled Lady didn't seem overly ambitious in the loyalty department. An uneasy, demilitarized zone had settled into place over the ship. Bridget returned only a few minutes later. She carried a blanket, a bowl, and a large tankard. She handed him all three. The bowl contained spicy soup, and the tankard held mulled wine. Kane looked the question at her.
Jeweled Lady is a cargo ship. She's heavy with goods that Harry Lindstrom, the de facto baron of Campecheville, sent as payment for the help Fiddler had been giving him in procuring immigrants. Maybe it won't be a comfortable trip across the Gulf, but we're not going to starve.
Tell me about the slave revolt in Egypt.
Bridget resumed her seat at the railing.
It wasn't a revolt. According to the Old Testament, the Christian God sent plagues and sicknesses among the pyramid builders. Eventually, fearing the wrath of the God, the Israelites were set free of the city and fled across the lands. The Pharaoh pursued them. Then the Red Sea was parted,
A whole sea?
Yes. And there was some documentation unveiled to support physical evidence that that event had happened.
Parting a sea sounds like something Enlil or Balam might be able to do with the tech they had.
During their search for the truth of the Archons, they had seen a number of amazing things. Parting a sea sounded simple when compared even to a Mattrans unit.
I don't know. None of the theories I ever read suggested anything like that. Of course, none of those writers and historians knew about the Archon Directive.
The Red Sea was parted, and the Israelites made their escape.
The Pharaoh and his people followed them into the Red Sea. Walls of water reportedly stood on either side of them. When the Israelites reached the other side of the sea, ahead of the pursuing Egyptians, the sea closed again, destroying the army that followed them.
Cain waited, savoring the soup and reliving the fever dream.
According to the Old Testament, the Israelites fell into depraved ways and didn't celebrate the God that had freed them from Egyptian tyranny. Moses journeyed up onto Mount Sinai and received the Ten Commandments that later became the cornerstone of that theology. Due to their excesses and failure to recognize the God that had freed them, as well as Moses' own pride during a later incident, the Israelites were doomed to wander for 40 years before they were delivered to the land of milk and honey they'd been promised.
Cain glanced up at Grant in the stern. He stood near the plotting deck and smoked, his cigar coal glowing orange against the dark night.
During their years of wandering in that harsh land, the Israelites were given the gift of manna. 6 days out of the week, but not on the Sabbath, because that was ordered to remain inviolate to spend worshiping their god, manna was said to rain down from the heavens.
Manna?
The descriptions I've read about it were basically that manna was some kind of confection. It was described as white and fluffy, having taste and texture, but also like milk whey. The Israelites were said to have gathered bushels of it to serve at meals for their families. Some treatises I've read suggest that the manna was manufactured by an alien machine.
Enlil's machine.
Maybe. There was never any proof. It was never found.
Moses took the machine that night.
Perhaps. But that doesn't explain why you're dreaming about it now.
Cain silently agreed. He finished his soup and settled back against the railing, pulling the blanket more tightly around him. He kept thinking about the dreams, turning them around every way that occurred to him, but he couldn't find any explanation that suited him. Whatever the reason, he was sure Balaam knew it. Somewhere in all that thinking, sleep reached out and took him. Lindstrom woke from the dream in a cold, shivering sweat. He peered around the room and found that he'd gone to sleep at his desk. He sucked in deep breaths, willing his heart to slow to something near normal. He pushed away from the desk and walked toward the balcony. Details of the dream in Egypt threaded through his mind. Cain had been there, as well as some other creature that Lindstrom was certain was somehow connected to Enlil. Cain had known the creature. He had called it by name, Balaam. Lindstrom had never before heard of the creature, nor did he have any clue as to what its purpose in his dreams was. But he was certain it didn't mean him any good. He paused at the doorway to the balcony and peered out at the moon-silvered water. The sky to the east was lightening, already turning a pinkish purple. Soon it would be morning. Lanterns burned in the morning mist that had descended over the bay during the night. They glowed softly in the streets of the ville, and they glowed distantly on the small cargo boats running barrels of oil into the warehouses along the shore. He'd deliberately stepped up the production schedule for the night, taking half loads into the warehouses instead of full ones. It would give the Tong spies more to count, and Lindstrom was certain there were spies. The Tong junk sat sedately at anchor in the harbor. Its pleated sails lay neatly folded in small stacks along the rigging. Armed crews walked the immaculate decks, and an officer in charge stood in the stern. The meeting yesterday with Wren and Yip had appeared to go well. Lindstrom felt good about that. If an arrangement could be made with Wei Kang, an arrangement without any duplicitous action on the part of the old Tong warlord, it would benefit them both. But Vasquez's arguments kept pulling at the logic Lindstrom tried to build on. With Kang's ships in the area, the Tong master would show no hesitation at stepping in to take over the oil reclamation operation if Lindstrom showed any weakness or proved unfit. He closed the doors to the balcony and returned to the large desk. Books lay scattered across it, and the oil lantern he'd been working by earlier had exhausted the fuel reservoir. Several of the books in his library had been on World War II, and a surprising number of them were in English. Still, he couldn't help wishing that he had access to the Sumeriumville archives for a few hours. Then the information he felt he lacked would be at his fingertips. He refilled the lantern reservoir and lit the wick, only then aware of the shadow that shifted in the main doorway. His heart froze for just a moment, but he made himself sit behind the desk.
How long have you been there?
Not long.
By not staring at Narita Vasquez directly, he was able to see her more clearly. When she had trained him to use his peripheral vision in the dark like that, he'd remembered other times in his dreams when he'd known to do it. So many things he now did stirred memories of the dreams.
I felt you around me today.
Vasquez said nothing. Lindstrom turned up the lantern's wick, making the bubble of light around his desk swell until it reached the doorway.
I wasn't imagining things, was I?
She didn't answer for a time, and Lindstrom didn't press her. The one thing he'd never experienced before was the feeling he had for her. She completed him in ways he'd never imagined, and being away from her yesterday, aware that she was gone not because she'd chosen to go on a voyage, but because she was deliberately staying away from him, had been more painful than he could have imagined.
No, you weren't imagining things. I watched over you.
I never saw you.
You weren't supposed to. If you had seen me, Ren and Yip, and their hatchet men, might have seen me as well.
Why were you watching me?
Lindstrom knew, but wanted her to say.
Because I don't trust the Tong as blithely as you seem to.
Vasquez shifted inside the doorway, then stepped forward and came into the room. She wore jeans and a long-sleeved shirt with the sleeves rolled up. Her hair was left unbound, cascading down her shoulders. She wore a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson semi-automatic pistol on her right hip, high and tucked into her side.
And what should it matter if they betray me? They might save you the trouble of wishing I was dead.
Vasquez frowned irritably and crossed her arms over her breasts.
Don't be petulant, Harry.
Lindstrom made himself breathe in and out.
I apologize.
He looked away from her harsh glance.
So what are we going to do?
She ignored the question and turned her attention to the books, maps, and papers on the desk.
What is this?
I was researching something.
What?
The U-boat I dreamed about.
Lindstrom glanced back at all the texts scattered across his desk.
What is a U-boat?
Lindstrom blinked as he looked at her, only then realizing that he hadn't had the chance to tell her about the nightmare he'd had the previous night.
A U-boat is an undersea boat, a submarine. The Germans used them extensively in World War II to take down British ships, as well as cargo ships.
Vasquez nodded. Her understanding of history had grown a lot during the years they'd been together. She didn't talk as much as he did, and he talked a lot about the way the world had been before the nuke cost. Some of those times had included the events that had led up to Skydark.
I had a dream that I was aboard one of those German submarines. It sank, and the man I'd been then drowned.
The experience remained vivid in his mind, and he noticed his hand shaking slightly as he moved some of the books around, searching for one of those he wanted. Vasquez didn't say anything.
I think the third piece of the machine is aboard that sunken German submarine.
And it's lost in the ocean?
It's not lost. I've found the other two pieces, Narita. I was guided to them through my dreams. I'll be guided to this piece as well.
Maybe you'll be guided to it, but being able to recover it is another matter if it's on the ocean floor.
That can't be the answer. I can't have been led this far only to be unable to recover the final piece.
You're certain it was aboard the U-boat?
Lindstrom nodded.
I dreamed about it again tonight.
That had been before the dream he'd had of Egypt and Cain and Balaam. This time, he'd seen through the German officer's eyes as the piece of the machine had been loaded onto the submarine. He'd carefully inventoried and stored the piece of the device. That had been during World War II, when the Nazis, at Hitler's orders, were gathering religious symbols.
It was there.
And the U-boat went down to the bottom of the sea?
It went down. Even as I was drowning, I could feel the change in water pressure as the submarine sank. Too many compartments in the submarine had been holed,
And the people dropping depth charges onto the U-boat had not given up the attack. They had our depth. There was no escape.
Then the submarine lies at the bottom of the sea.
Lindstrom explained the thoughts he'd had while researching the war during the previous evening. Maybe it drifted. Enough air could have remained trapped in it that it was buoyant for a while, maybe years.
All that means is that even if you knew where it went down, you won't find this submarine.
The submarine went down in the Gulf of Mexico.
Vasquez glanced at the books.
You found the submarine you dreamed about?
I believe so. During World War II, between the years of 1942 and 1943, a fleet of 20 German U-boats were assigned to the Gulf of Mexico. Their orders were to sink any oil tankers and supply ships coming from Texas and Louisiana.
That's not far from here.
She moved closer. Lindstrom smelled her fragrance and longed to touch her, but he kept himself from doing so, afraid to break any of the rapport they now shared. It's not far from here at all. The submarine I was on was the U-166. He'd seen the markings in the second dream, as well as been introduced to the captain. It was the only confirmed casualty among the German submarines in the Gulf of Mexico. It was sunk 20 miles off the Louisiana coast by what was reportedly a torpedo plane, but it was the depth charges that really put it down.
What happened to the other U-boats?
They pulled out of the area once the merchant vessels started sailing with armed convoys after 1943. But before they were sunk, they put down 56 Allied vessels. During that time, the United States also succeeded in opening an oil-supplying pipeline from Texas to New Jersey, which meant that tankers were no longer needed to transport the crude oil.
Where is the U-66?
Vasquez studied the nautical map he had located that displayed the Gulf of Mexico. Lindstrom grew more hopeful as he embraced the facts of the German ship's disappearance again. No one knows. 39 of the U-boat commander's confirmed kills still lay in waters just off the coasts of Louisiana, Texas, and Florida before the nuke cost.
Then they may still be there.
Vasquez ran a slim forefinger south of Louisiana, across the Gulf waters. Maybe. But with all the upheaval caused by the nukes and the changes that took place in undersea volcanoes in the Pacific Ocean, not to mention the displacement of the California coastline and the Baja Peninsula when the Earthshaker bombs tore them free, that may not be true anymore.
It's also true, then, that the U-166 may no longer be there.
No, it may not be. It could be somewhere closer to where we are now.
Harry.
Hesitation showed on Vasquez's beautiful face. What?
I don't want you to get your hopes up. Having these dreams the way you are now is bad enough.
Having the dreams isn't bad.
I worry about you.
She touched his face with her hand, but Lindstrom noticed that her other hand was never more than an inch or two away from her holstered pistol. I'm glad. Her face hardened a little, but she didn't take her hand away.
I'm not. I've got enough to do to worry about keeping my own neck intact.
I'll look out for you. Aligning ourselves with Wei Kang is one way to solidify our position here.
Our position here is due largely to our ability to feed all the people you insist on bringing to this area.
There's safety in numbers.
Not when those numbers are hungry and pissed off.
Lindstrom gazed into her dark eyes, seeing more than a hint of worry there. What's wrong?
You've been so involved in these dreams that you haven't paid attention to some of the other things going on around you.
Both times I found the other pieces to the machine, my dream cycle intensified. The same way it is now. Only it's never been this intense before. We're close to the third piece, Narita. I don't know how I know, but I do. Just give me a little more time.
The latest shipments are 3 days late. In the next few days, the people here on this barren piece of rock are going to know that they don't have anything to eat.
The news hit Lindstrom hard, and he tried to remember if someone had told him that earlier. The ships will be here before then.
And if they're not?
We can send a ship to Fiddlerville or some of the other coastal villes that we've been supporting. It won't take long to get a shipment in. We've got fuel, and everybody around Samariumville trades for fuel.
Some of those coastal villes have fallen to the slavers. That's another thing the ship's captains have been getting upset about. The waters are turning dangerous out there, Harry. The best way to stay ahead of the sharks is to stay fast and mobile. You changed all that when you decided to open up shop here. And then there's the matter of the oil. Everyone would take that away if they could.
Desperation seized Lindstrom, and he had to work hard to keep the black anger swirling inside him from spilling over.
What Narita said was true. He'd always managed to stay at best only a step or three ahead of a famine that would have swept through Campecheville in spite of the oil. That was one of the main reasons no one had settled there, and why it had taken so long to get a community started.
That's all the more reason to find the other piece of the machine. Once we have it, food will never be a problem again. You do believe the stories that I've told you about it, don't you?
She looked at him.
I know that you believe them.
So can you.
She didn't say anything.
It's true.
Vasquez looked as if she wanted to say something, but she never got the chance. A clanging bell suddenly ripped through the early morning, shattering the stillness and the quiet of the beginning day. Lindstrom cursed, resenting the interruption before he got the feeling that things had been put right between them. Still, they were guided by a common goal as they moved quickly toward the balcony doors. The bells were only used to announce an unexpected visitor. Standing out in the cool morning light, surprised at the heavy, cottony fog that swelled out on the bay and lay heavily over the ville, Lindstrom gazed out at the sea. Only patches of the dark green water could be seen through the white haze. But farther out to sea, two tall masts stood proudly, their sails catching the southerly wind.
What ship is that?
Vasquez took up the binoculars she'd thought to remove from his desk on her way. She was more familiar with all of the ships that traded with Campecheville than he was.
From the cut of her, she looks like Howard's Kingfisher, but that can't be.
Why not?
Because Kingfisher is rigged with three masts. That one out there only has two.
Lindstrom watched as the harbor patrol he'd arranged for went into action. Long, narrow boats sporting heavy machine guns, torpedoes, and anti-aircraft weapons sped toward the arriving ship.
She's been in a fight.
How do you know?
The ship's still smoldering. This can't be good news, Harry. And it would probably be better if we tried to contain it.
Lindstrom's stomach tightened at the mixture of emotions he suddenly felt. Another thing going wrong wasn't what he wanted to deal with. But Narita had said we, which made him feel instantly hopeful. Nothing could defeat both of them if they were together. He followed Narita out of the room.
Fucking fire blast, Lindstrom. I've got wounded aboard ship that need tending to. You can't keep us tied up here.
Howard was shouting across the expanse of ocean between the cargo ship and Lindstrom's speedboat. Lindstrom stared at the gaping holes in Kingfisher's upper deck. Wounded lay under blankets and thick coats along the powder-burned wood. Most of the cargo ship's railing had been torn away by enemy fire, as well as by grappling hooks. Lindstrom knew about the hooks, because some of them were still embedded in the wood and entangled in the rigging. Smoke still eddied into the foggy morning from the charred areas aboard the ship. The stench of smoke burned Lindstrom's nose. Vasquez ordered the speedboat crew to take them in closer to Kingfisher. At her command, despite his own protests over the delay, Howard had his crew roll out a rope ladder. Without hesitation, Vasquez climbed the ladder and stepped aboard the cargo ship. Lindstrom followed, aware of the hostile gazes that the crew turned in his direction as he surveyed the damage.
What happened?
Vasquez kept walking to the center of the deck, obviously aiming for the hatch leading to the ship's hold.
We were attacked. Doesn't it fucking look like it?
Only then did Lindstrom notice the blood staining the captain's shirt.
You were wounded.
Hell yes, but it's a damn sight better than being chilled the way a lot of these other people were.
Vasquez returned to Lindstrom's side.
The hold's empty. What wasn't taken was damaged by fire and flooding.
That's right. The bastard Coldhearts that did this aimed to see the cargo taken or destroyed. If I hadn't offloaded it to them, they'd have chilled us all.
Vasquez stepped toward the captain.
You dumped the cargo?
Howard took a fearful step back.
I didn't have a fucking choice, Narita. You see what they've done to this fucking ship? And that was with me agreeing to their terms. The only thing that kept them off us entirely was that once they'd loaded up with our cargo, they didn't want to take the chance we'd get lucky and rip out their ship's hull below the waterline. It would have been a slow death, maybe, but it definitely would have done for the cargo they'd just stolen.
Who did this?
Howard shook his head.
I don't know. Most of the men aboard that ship, I didn't know them. They were well outfitted and not hesitant at all about chilling anybody.
They knew you were sailing for Campecheville?
I told them. I told them as plain as a man could tell them. But they didn't give a shit. Nobody gives a shit, Lindstrom, because you don't have the sense to protect... Ugh!
Without warning, Vasquez backhanded the wounded captain hard enough to snap his head around. Two men standing against the railing reached for their blasters. The woman swept her blaster from her hip in the blink of an eye.
If they come out of those holsters, you die.
Slowly, nodding their understanding, the two men raised their hands from their holstered weapons. Vasquez didn't put her weapon away. She looked at Howard again.
If you trade here, then you'll respect the port.
If this kind of shit keeps up, ain't nobody gonna trade at Campecheville.
Then where will they get the fucking fuel you need to trade with the coastal vills?
Howard didn't have an answer for that. Lindstrom strode over to the hatch and peered into the hold. He couldn't help wondering how many of the crew would have killed him then and there if they'd had the chance. He felt dozens of hot gazes on him. The hold was nearly empty. Only a few broken crates and flotsam remained. As he watched, a rat swam through the water that nearly covered the hold's floor. Kingfisher had taken on a lot of water. A bilge pump crew remained at work, creating a steady thump of noise as the pumps battled the incoming sea.
We've been holed. Took a bunch of armor-piercing rounds below the waterline. The bilge pumps can't even break even with it.
You're sinking.
Slowly but surely. Campecheville was the closest place to put in for repairs.
And despite your protests, you know it's also the most generous when it comes to men and materials. You knew I'd refit your ship and provide the manpower to see it done.
You got a vested interest in Kingfisher, too.
Lindstrom walked toward the man.
That's right. We've got a vested interest in each other. You might want to remember that at times other than just when you want something from me.
Howard returned his gaze.
And you might want to remember that when someone's trying to take a cargo from you that I've already paid for. I was depending on that cargo to feed those people in that vill.
With the fog hanging heavy over the area, Campecheville could barely be seen on the other side of the bay. But it was clear enough to see that a crowd had turned out to see what was going on. Lindstrom knew they were going to be demanding answers. In fact, they were going to be demanding more than that, because he'd been depending on Howard's ship to supplement the existing stores within the vill. According to the latest inventory, they had less than 2 days of food left. There was no choice but to start rationing food now, if they were going to make it.
I bartered for some more immigrants. I still got most of them. But knowing you got even more mouths to feed at a time like this probably isn't something you wanted to know.
Lindstrom walked away from the man, not knowing what to say. He felt as if he were teetering on the brink of disaster, and it scared the hell out of him. As he peered out across the bay, though, he noticed the movement aboard the Tong ship still sitting at anchor.
How much longer are the Tong going to be here?
3 or 4 more days. Long enough for them to watch us start starving if something doesn't happen. And when they do, when Wei Qiang sees the weaknesses we have here, there won't be an agreement between the Tong and Campecheville. They'll starve us out and feast on us like lions on Christians.
Vasquez looked at him, clearly not understanding the reference.
It's from an old story. Maybe I'll tell it to you one day.
Okay.
Lindstrom looked out at the fog over the bleak sea.
If I could find that third part to the machine, Narita, we'd never have any problems. At least food wouldn't be a problem. If you can feed people, you can lead people.
It was the truth. All he had to do was make it a reality. His eyes swept the bay, thinking about the missing German submarine. The U-166 had gone down in the Gulf. It had to be out there somewhere. And with it was the missing piece of the machine the aliens had first given the Pharaohs. The machine had also fallen into the hands of Moses and his people. From there it had been protected, not even used. The secret of its operation had died with Moses and the Pharaohs. But Lindstrom still knew how to use it. He had learned about the process while he dreamed of the Egyptians, and he'd learned about it again while wandering with the Israelites for 40 years, while they'd waited for their promised land. He was probably the only man on the planet who knew how to use the machine. The barons had never even gone seeking it. They had either forgotten its existence or had believed it destroyed. No one thought about the machine anymore. That is, no one thought about the machine except Cain. The fear resonated within Lindstrom, sharp and edgy. Cain had stopped him from possessing the machine in the past. Lindstrom stared at Campecheville. The past didn't matter. It had all been stepping stones to this place and time. He wouldn't allow Cain to stop him again. Lindstrom looked to the west, wondering if Cain was as close as the missing piece of the machine. In all of the tangled pasts they'd shared, Cain always had been.
Ambitious project.
Grant stared down into the dark water of the bay. He flicked ashes from his cigar over the ship's railing.
but they get a hell of a payoff.
Kane silently agreed, staring at the ships and floating oil rigs that worked the Bay of Campecheville. The noise of the generator-powered equipment made it hard to hold a conversation. The water trapped the noise, making it even louder.
What they doing?
Domi stood beside Grant. Since they'd entered the bay leading to Campecheville, Blakeney, captain of Jeweled Lady, had calmed down considerably. It wasn't likely that he'd forget Domi had threatened his life and stripped command of the ship from him, but he hadn't moved aggressively against any of his unplanned passengers from Fiddlerville. Bridget indicated the floating platforms.
The oil rigs are obviously tapping into the underwater and underground wells, but the smaller tugs and platforms must be tapping submerged vessels whose holds are filled with oil.
Fiddler joined them.
And other things. When the new cost hit, there were a number of ships in this area. Lindstrom told me about it.
She nodded toward the bleak coastline of the mainland, nearly a mile away. Kane studied the buildings standing at the water's edge in the distance. He knew that some of the structures lay submerged beneath the waves because he could see the tops of buildings sticking up from the water in different places. Buoys marked other places in irregular shapes, and the tugboats plying their cargoes back to the mainland or returning to the staging platforms steered well clear of those areas.
Before Skydark, this place was a resortville, a place where people came and spent a lot of jack trying to relax. When the waters rose and the ships went down here, there were a lot of losses. Every now and then, some of the captains told me Lindstrom's crews managed to get one of the ships sealed off below if the water's not too deep. Then they pump it full of air and float it to the top. They salvage some goods and electronics if they can, though not very much most of the time, and stainless steel tools and equipment they can use or barter with.
Kane watched the divers work in the water as Jeweled Lady sailed on into the harbor. Hardly anyone watched the ship pass through. Evidently, the sight was a familiar one.
How many people does Lindstrom have in the Ville?
I've never heard any exact numbers. A few thousand, surely. But those numbers change every time a ship arrives. Mostly people who intend to stay, but there are a few who come down here that aren't happy. Farming is too hard for people who are interested in tilling the soil, and they can't grow the things they're used to growing back in the Villes they left. So they stay for a while, then they push on. Some join up with ship's crews, others die. The work out here is dangerous.
But not everyone works out here. There are several people working the shore,
and farther into the Ville. Lindstrom is reclaiming the Ville as well. Campecheville died very quickly during the nuke cost. The stores and mercantiles that didn't go underwater remain dry, and they have a number of supplies that can still be used. Lindstrom uses those for barter as well.
Kane took his binoculars from the war bag he carried. He scanned the barren coast, picking up the shelves of limestone rock jutting from the sea and the beaches as well. Vegetation was sparse, limited to a few palm trees and stubborn brush, broken up by hints and patches of bougainvillea and tropical flowers. He spotted walls farther into the Ville.
There are fortifications, too.
Lindstrom started getting prepared for an invasion the day he got here and started pumping oil from the first submerged tanker. Over the years, he's had to fight off his share of pirates and other cold hearts.
Peering out at the coastline again, Kane spotted the red-lacquered Tong warship. A couple moments later, he found the two small air wags tied up at docks.
Wei Kang's people are here.
Fiddler peered forward.
Yeah. I'd heard that Lindstrom might be going into business with him. You know about Wei Qiang?
Yeah. He's a tough bastard.
He'd first encountered the old Tong warlord when they'd followed up on Ambika after encountering her handiwork in the Utah territories a few months back. They'd also encountered and ultimately brokered a deal between Tong representatives for Qiang and Tyler Falzone and the Lost Valley of Y2K, which had actually turned out to be the Silicon Valley of Seattle, submerged beneath the sea. Fiddler stared at Kane.
You have a lot of secrets, Kane. Not many people know of Wei Qiang out here, and here you are sounding like you know him.
Yeah, I have secrets, and I keep them.
Kane nodded toward the Tong warship.
If Kang gets the opportunity, he'll take these oil fields from Lindstrom.
Lindstrom's not in any more danger from Qiang than he is from any other cold heart out here. And even with the overland travel routes Qiang's people used to haul the cargoes across Mexico to the Pacific Ocean,
Trying to take and hold Campecheville would stretch him too thin.
Maybe. But Kang isn't about to let anyone else take this place if he can help it. Fuel is an addiction to someone making the kinds of empire-building plans Kang is making.
Kang holds the Western Isles.
And he'd like to hold more.
Fiddler glanced at Grant, but quickly saw that he wasn't going to be any quicker about explaining how he knew the Tong warlord either.
Look at all people. Like bunch of locusts running around. Vill this big, they eat too much. Hard put back extra stores for bad time. Fucking locusts for sure.
The albino's words rang a bell inside Kane's head, and he thought about the machine he'd seen in Egypt. Harkuf's words came back to him.
It makes the nectar of the gods, Kane. That machine can make food from the very air itself, and it can feed armies of people. And if you can feed a people...
You can lead a people.
What did you say?
Kane shook his head.
It wasn't important, Baptiste.
Gotta be a hell of a butcher's bill for a place this full of people. Domi's right about that.
Lindstrom gives food away to the coastal vills that help him with his recruitment.
Not easily. I've had shipments come in weeks late before. Even with all the fuel he's tapping into here, Lindstrom still has to find places and people to trade with. And there are enough cold hearts who've taken to pirating to make these waters more dangerous than ever. Even Narita the Bleeder was a total hard case when it came to seizing ships before she got involved with Lindstrom.
Kane looked at all the reclamations operations going on around him.
These people can't eat the oil they're pumping.
His brain danced with images of the machine he'd seen. If such a machine truly existed that could make food out of the air, and it could be found here, Lindstrom would have an empire at his fingertips. No one would be able to stop him from continuing to grow and build. A cool wind came up out of the west, filling Jeweled Lady's sails and pushing her more deeply into the harbor. Kane felt the residual fever still burning within him. Whatever had been going on within him regarding the dreams hadn't finished yet. A crowd of armed men met Jeweled Lady at the docks. They held back a greater crowd of people from the cargo ship, and most of those people looked sullen and angry. Blakeney put out planks, and a small party of the armed force boarded the cargo ship. The leader, Radke, was a tall, gaunt man with a pockmarked face and half his right ear missing. The man roared at them in a voice that was louder than Kane would have expected based on his size.
Listen up! This here's your welcome to Campecheville. For all of you sailors that has been here before, know that you ain't going to be staying long. Baron Lindstrom has got needs that need tending to. You'll be getting an immediate restock on cargo.
Outraged, Blakeney interrupted.
We didn't get rid of the last restock. Cimmerianville magistrates took Fiddlerville. We barely got out of there with whole skins.
What about the food you were sending to Fiddlerville? Strip the food that was going to be left for Fiddlerville. Leave everything else.
You can't do that. My crew and I have got to have something to eat.
Fish, fat man. You look like you've been sitting down to one meal too many as it is.
Blakeney sputtered and cursed, but he didn't make an effort to stop the line of Sekhmen that suddenly fell into position to unload the cargo hold. Radke turned his attention to the rest of the crowd on deck.
The rest of you people can make your choice now. You can stay here and work for your meals, doing work that needs to be done around Campecheville, or you can go on this ship when it leaves.
He nodded toward the gangplank.
It's time to make your choice.
Grant looked at Kane.
It might be better if we went with Blakeney. From what I'm seeing here, Lindstrom ain't doing so well.
Kane replied just as quietly, so more than Domi and Bridget wouldn't overhear him.
We've come this far. Let's find out about that Metrans unit.
But he knew it was more than that. His dreams had somehow drawn him there as well. The fever coiled restlessly inside him.
Starting immediate food shipments to Campecheville will require an audience with Lord Kang.
Lindstrom regarded Wren, the Tong representative, across the table in one of the gaudy houses down in the docks. A nearby lantern lit the table area, raising the Tong man's features in buttery gold highlights. They'd gone there to talk, and the ground was as neutral as he could make it. He had no doubt the Tong wouldn't let him on their ship, and he didn't want Wren nor his hatchet men escort to set foot in his private offices.
I've got shipments of fuel that I could send out immediately, as a show of good faith.
Or desperation, he couldn't help thinking. He knew better than to expect that Wren or any of the Tong wouldn't know how badly the current situation affected Campecheville. Despite how well he paid them or how profitable their relationship with him was, ship's captains would gladly give information for extra jack.